Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast of the Financial Times. This is the marriage and kids can be expensive, but at least they're also a huge headache episode. I'm Cardiff Garcia. On the show today, first, I visit my old pal and colleague and, of course, Alpha Chat co-host Shannon Bond for a chat about the economics of becoming a new parent. Shannon is actually still on maternity leave, so Amy and I crashed her Harlem apartment for this conversation. And then afterwards, Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell joins us back here in the New York studio for a look at how marriage trends are changing and what they mean societally and for the economy. So here we go. And for the first segment of the show, we are in the Harlem home of Shannon Bond, co-host of Alpha Chat. Shannon, welcome back.
Hi, Cardiff.
You know how long it's been since I've been able to introduce somebody and not say guest host?
About 5.5 months.
That's right.
6 months.
That's right. That's right. You are still deep in the throes of maternity leave. We're just, you know, Amy and I just decided to drop in on you for a quick segment.
Well, welcome to Harlem.
I know. It's great. So you want to give us a little bit of a, give our listeners kind of a sense of where we are right now, what's
sure.
happening?
So we're sitting in my living room at our kitchen table, and there's a pot of soup boiling away on the stove that my husband is currently cooking, and Merritt is making a special appearance. You might be able to hear him in the background. He has the hiccups.
He's adorable when he has the hiccups, by the way.
He's adorable most of the time, but yeah, the hiccups is particularly hilarious.
Indeed. There's a good reason that Amy and I decided to interrupt your time bonding with your child, though, which is we wanted to do a segment on the economics of child rearing and of having a new baby. And as I happen to be single and childless, okay,
I'm your perfect test case here.
I didn't think I could speak to it with quite as much authority as you can. So my role, I think, is just going to be to ask the questions and respond and maybe drop a few data points, and you can tell us what's going on. So let me start with actually a personal question, right? A lot of people know that when you have a new kid, number one, you don't get a lot of sleep. And number two, sometimes it's a bit of a shock how expensive it is. Has anything about it like surprised you 5 months in?
Yes. And yet it is. I think one of the things that my husband, Jesse, and I said to each other a lot in the beginning is like, this is really, really hard. And the thing is, especially when you're pregnant, people tell you all the time. First of all, they tell you it's going to be really hard. They tell you your life is going to change. That, you know, everything is going to be just turned upside down. And that's all true. And you can understand that all intellectually. And then it happens. And you're like, oh, my God, this is really hard. And right. My life has completely changed. I mean, so I would just say like the actual experience of going through it was something as prepared as you can be for it. You're not really prepared for.
Right. Like intuitively, I could write down all the things that I would imagine you're going through. And you could probably check them off and say, yeah, that's true. That's true. Yep. That's true. But viscerally,
living it is, yeah, living
is a whole different story.
A whole other experience. Yeah. And it's, I mean, you know, you've never known sort of the sleep deprivation until you've had the sleep deprivation of those early weeks.
Okay. Let's talk about the economics of having a kid then.
Oh,
right.
My God.
Yeah. Let me throw one number at you. It's the one that jumped out at me while doing research for this segment. According to New America, it's a think tank, the average cost of daycare in the U.S. is $9,600. That's roughly the same as it costs to go to an in-state college for a year. How does that make you feel?
Well, luckily, we live in New York City, so I don't even I shudder to think what the average cost of daycare right. is here. No, it's real. That number is a proportion of our budget. Like our, you know, once I go back to work and we're not even sure what we're going to do. We started to look into both the nanny situation as well as daycares. It's, you know, it's a real challenge, like thinking about that, thinking about the amount we're going to be spending. You know, we already live in a very expensive city. You know, we spend a good proportion of our income on rent. I think as a lot of New Yorkers right. do, and childcare is definitely going to be a cost that goes that's adding into that. And you know, we're incredibly lucky, actually. So we're in a, I would venture to guess, a very small percentage of the populations would have the situation that Jesse and I have, which is that I had quite a long maternity leave. I got 6 months from the FT. And he has 3 months of paternity leave, which is, you know, for our non-American listeners, is like almost unheard of in the U.S.
Right.
And so he actually, Jesse took some time off when I first had the baby, and then he's going to take some time off when I go back to work. Mm-hmm. So we're in a really lucky situation where Merritt will be almost 9 months old by the time we're actually having to pay for childcare for the first time. So that's 9 months that we've managed to get away with not paying for it.
Right.
Which will make a huge difference when you talk about those costs. At the same time, one of the things, you know, I had sort of knew it intellectually, but it's different actually experiencing it. You know, you're really in the U.S., you're on your own until in the New York pre-K, universal pre-K starts at 4 years old. But those first 4 years, I mean, you can spend a college tuition, you know, sending your kid to daycare, to preschool, you know, to potentially pre-pre-K.
Yeah. So, I mean, your options then are either both of you keep working, but then you have to pay somebody else to do it. And as we've just discussed, that's really expensive. Or somebody stays home, but then you give up the income that way, which in its own way is also incredibly expensive.
Yeah. I mean, you see it particularly, you know, I think in really high cost cities and just in general, I think it's something like 23 states where the median cost of childcare is like higher than the median rent, right?
Yeah, it's 40% in some of these lower income states.
So in those sort of cases, you actually see why it can make a lot of economic sense actually for one parent, it's often the mother, to stop working. Because if I'm going to work and the only reason I'm working is to pay for somebody else to take care of my child, if I'm not keeping any take-home pay, then – sorry, Merritt's
making – That's making Merritt noise making his debut on the podcast. He's really excited. Yeah.
But you hear more and more from people – you know, about how they're dealing with the financial squeeze when they have kids is, you know, maybe they're maybe just able to cover, you know, all of their obligations, their monthly bills, their rent, their childcare, but they're not saving for retirement, or, you know, they're having to pick up an extra job. Just there's a lot of things, you know, where you're really juggling. And then you throw into, I think, you know, a lot of people our age are increasingly having, you know, their parents are older. They talk about this, you know, the sandwich generation, right, where you both have your own children to take care of and potentially your elderly parents to support. It becomes
because
really
– people are waiting until a little bit later in life to start families.
Exactly. And, you know, back to your question about, you know, for the idea that for some people it's just going to make more sense, like, not to work. I mean, that's one of the other things that I think is really confounding and is really – it's really difficult when you think about deciding to become a parent, and particularly for mothers – in so many ways, it feels like the economic incentives discourage you from working as a mother. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole question of, like, can you have it all? But it's not, you know, can I have a career, and can I, you know, be the best parent that I can? I mean, aside from all of the time issues, the pure financial issues, it's really, really difficult.
Sure. And to stay with that theme for a second, I want to cite some findings from a new paper by Alexandra Stanzik, an economist. The, I think, biggest finding she had was that as childbirth approaches and then in the immediate years afterwards, U.S. household income declines quite a bit. Most of that has to do with the decline in the mother's income.
Right, the time that she's probably having
exactly.
to take off.
So you can imagine the sort of obvious way in which this happens. She takes time off. Maybe she doesn't have generous maternity leave, so she's just straight up giving up the income. Right. But what's interesting about that is that for mothers who don't have generous packages and who are less educated in general, there's an incredibly steep decline as the date of the childbirth arrives, and then it shoots right back up not far afterwards, but it stays below. Right,
right. They're not getting back to their pre-parenthood wages.
For educated mothers who usually do have access to more generous maternity leave, right?
And potentially paid maternity leave.
It declines, but then it takes a very long mm-hmm. time for it to get back to where it was. And again, you can kind of imagine how that could happen. So in the year, for instance, in the 6 months that you're taking off, right, you're not doing, say, freelance assignments. Mm-hmm. You're not getting paid to speak at conferences. You're also not at the job. So if you were putting in the work that might lead to either a promotion later on mm-hmm. Or to an assignment that would have paid you a little more money, you're not doing that.
Right.
And so even in your case, you could see how it would take a little bit longer to get back to the trajectory that you were on before.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I have found really frustrating, especially sort of during this political season that we're in, is that, you know, the conversation, because the U.S. is so far behind so many other developed countries, we don't have any mandatory paid family leave, right? I mean, essentially the best you can kind of be guaranteed is that if you work at a company that employs more than 50 people, you can't get fired for taking 12 weeks off, but they don't have to pay you. I mean, increasingly, companies, particularly like in the tech industry, you know, companies are starting to offer more generous packages and offer pay during leave, but it's still not the norm at all, right? So most people are taking whatever leave they can. It's going to be unpaid, and it's therefore going to be limited. But it goes so far beyond that. So of course, like we want to address that. But it also then gets into subsidizing childcare. It gets into making it possible for people to feel that they can go back and be productive. And like, yes, you recognize you're taking that time off, and you're going to be maybe a little bit behind when you come back. But are you then able to reenter the workforce in a way where you're supported, and that you feel that you can really like do all that you can at work while also feel like you're not kind of sidelining your family, right?
So. Right, yeah. I want to address a criticism that I can already anticipate coming from some listeners, and specifically from listeners who share circumstances closer to mine than to yours, right? In other words, single childless people who might say, well, hang on a second. You knew that raising a kid was going to be expensive. It's true that you're going to take a hit in your income and maybe a hit to your career, but you get compensated with a bigger family, with the love of your child, with the knowledge that when you're older, you'll have, you'll have a kid or two, and you might even have grandkids. So why should there be a distribution from the childless to people with kids when that was your choice? I actually have a response to that, and I think it's a pretty good one. It's not a novel one, but I think it still holds, which is that actually a growing population is a public good, that as the population grows, you have a bigger economy, you have more specialization, mm-hmm. you have more people buying things, you have more people making things, and it's an awful lot of work to do that. And so in some sense, I'm actually quite happy to use my tax dollars to help parents do that job, right? And that's just, speaking on it in very cold utilitarian terms, I think it still makes sense. Let me move off the subject of cost now to productivity, which is what you were talking about earlier. Because I love this idea of now having to set boundaries at work and how actually that can make you more efficient during the time you actually do spend at work, because you're not sort of thinking, well, I have all day and then even half the night to get this done. Actually, by 5 or 6 o'clock, I need to get going because I need to get home, or even earlier. It makes you think that maybe more of us should be better about this anyways, that just for the sake of leading a more balanced life, even if you don't have a kid to go home to, you should be doing that.
And we live in one of the worst professions for that, or we work in one of the worst professions for that, frankly. I mean,
because the news is always happening. What's interesting about this, though, is that in a way it seems to introduce like a sense of purpose into your work, not your work specifically, Shannon Bond, but like
that remains
in,
to be seen.
Right. No, but like a sense of purpose into jobs where maybe it doesn't exist. Yeah. And I think at least among the educated classes, there's all this pressure to like find work that you love all the time, as if we should all be doing jumping jacks every minute of the day because we're so happy to be at our jobs. I've always thought that was really kind of silly. And then there's a sense of disappointment when you're in a job that doesn't provide that incredible sense of transcendent meaning that you thought you'd have when you got older and you were in the workforce. It seems like, well, having a kid is a pretty good remedy for that disappointment, because now it does have that sense of purpose, that even if every minute of that you're doing your job isn't like this amazingly joyous, perfect moment, you know that it's going towards a very significant end, which is raising your kid.
Yeah. My one pushback to that would be one of the experiences I've had, over the past 5 months, is that this is all encompassing, taking care of a child, and it's in many ways exciting and exhausting. It can also be really tedious, and it's increasingly important for me as I'm less sleep deprived and I'm kind of more used to it, to have conversations with people that are not about kids, and to have some sort of intellectual engagement going on in my brain. I've been reading more in the past month or so, watching TV, all of these things. And I think one of the things that's really important for me, I think I will be a better parent, A, because I'm working. Like, ultimately, I think kind of in the grand scheme of things, yes, like, would I love to be able to spend more time with my kid that I'm not going to be able to spend because I'm at work? Yeah. But I actually think sort of as a holistic person, like I will be better for like the time I will have with him will be better because I will have time that is not with him where I'm doing other things and engaging. My work doesn't need to be my be all and end all, but I want it to be something that I care about doing.
Sure. I should note also one piece of research that we looked at before this segment. It'll be very fast because it's actually it's a paper by economists about economists, right?
Very self-selecting.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. And,
you but know, really interesting.
Super caveat laden, basically. The sample size was 10,000. It essentially showed that throughout the course of their careers and at every phase of their careers, men and women with kids were actually more productive per hour, more mm-hmm. efficient than men and women without kids. Now, obviously, some of that is going to be like a kind of a self-selecting sample where like people who are just super organized and efficient anyways might be more likely to have children, mm-hmm. okay? But even
or
so
– to be economists.
Or to be economists, right? And it's only one profession and it's like people with PhDs. So this is a very, very, very niche slice of the population. Everybody should keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. But the female productivity story was more complicated than that for men where the differences were actually pretty small, right? There was a big productivity loss associated with the early years of having a kid. It's just that the mothers were so much more productive anyways that even taking into account that loss, they were still more productive than childless women right. at every single stage of their careers. I thought that was really quite fascinating. I don't know if that holds across the rest of the population or even across other like social science academics. Who the hell knows?
Right. But no, right? It's interesting this idea that you essentially what's the best cure for procrastination, right? Or, you know, you just need to get stuff done. And you can see why that would be true.
No, totally. Here's one last part of this topic that I want to address. And it's one that I think is maybe more worrying, something that might be a negative, right? Which is that if you think about creative occupations, and I'll go ahead and throw journalism in there for now, right? Because it does involve like a creative turn of phrase. It does involve coming up with topics and like making links between things. So I'm talking about creative occupations or jobs that you don't traditionally think of as creative, but that involve very heavy elements of creativity in them, of imaginative, you know, ideas, concepts, connections that you have to make. We know from the research that having great creative insights often requires both intensive thinking about something, but then also a period of like relaxation mm-hmm. away from it where you're thinking about something else, where you're essentially letting your mind roam free. Essentially, it's playtime for adults, right? And that when you're not thinking about it later on and your brain is sort of ruminating over it, you have this like aha moment, right. You know? It seems to me that even if you are super efficient at your job, at getting done like your to-do list, right? You know, and then you go home and you see your kid and your whole day was really efficient, that maybe the one thing you'd be missing from that day is that time of like, I'm just stepping away from this. I'm going to like read a book about something else,
right.
Or play a game of chess or like watch a show, you know, or I'm just going to sit out on the patio and have a cup of tea.
Well, that's by definition, you know? Like the time, that, like if you have, when you're looking at sort of at the, you know, the pie chart of your day, like what are you going to shrink in order to accommodate these new demands? Like that's right. Probably the natural place. But yeah, but it's probably, I'll report back in a couple of months, but yeah. I imagine that will be an incredible challenge.
I guess the way I would react to that, though, is to say that that would be the most natural thing that you'd shrink, but it's probably a mistake to shrink that, right? Like, it's probably a better idea to cut out an hour of, like, the time that you're at your desk, mm-hmm. you know, get away from it and take, like, a nice walk in the park or something like that. That actually, that's a more efficient use of your time or it's a better use of your time, you know, for your whole career. Okay, final topic I want to discuss. It's the motherhood penalty and the fatherhood bonus. There's a lot of research on this. We've spoken before about the gender wage gap and how it's very small. It exists, but it's very small after college and in the first few years of your 20s. And then it opens up quite significantly during the child-rearing years, right?
For the reasons, part of the reasons we talked about, right? That women are going to be out of the workforce and those sort of that ways in which you might slightly fall behind, but then it like compounds.
Right. But Claudia Golden, the economist that we've cited on this before, essentially found that it had to do with like three kinds of jobs though, right? Mm-hmm. Law, finance, and then what I think she referred to as like corporate management, which, mm-hmm. you know, can apply across industries, mm-hmm. but it had to do with like upper level managerial positions, you know? And Essentially, these were jobs that had one thing in common, which was they had nonlinear effects on pay, where if you work 35 hours, you get paid X amount. But if you work 70 hours at those jobs, you got way more than 2X amount, right? And it seems to me like the real issue here then is that for women with kids, it's impossible to work those jobs and also spend a lot of time with your family.
Right. And you potentially get penalized for doing it. I mean,
you definitely get penalized for it.
With the idea that, like, if a mother leaves work early because of, you know, and it's known that she's going to a child's doctor's appointment or a play or whatever, or soccer practice, like, she is seen more negatively than somebody else leaving early for a different reason, but it's not related to their kids, right?
A couple of other studies that we'll link to, one from the American Journal of Sociology. This was a lab test, but I think one that was really quite telling, where essentially it was one of those tests where they sent out like a bunch of resumes that all looked the same except for one thing that was different. In one case, the woman had kids. In another case, she didn't. And it turned out that in terms of perceptions, right, those mothers with kids were thought to be less competent and to deserve a lower starting salary. I mean, when
it's really discouraging.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, when you hear something like that, do you think that's something that can get better over time, or is that something that you think is going to sort of forever be fixed?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think if we think it really is in some ways like endemic to a certain set of professions that have like a certain set of norms and expectations that are probably slow to change, then maybe not, because frankly, like, that's the argument, if like you knew what you were getting into going into a corporate law firm, right? Like, this is what the expectation, if you want to make partner, like, this is what you have to do, and it doesn't matter what you're doing in the rest of your life, this is what you have to do. You know, I think if we think that it maybe doesn't have as strong effects in other types of employment, but that in general, like, you know, there's sort of more broader social perception of this, I think it could change. I mean, particularly, you know, we talk too much about millennials, but you know, I think that there's a lot of certainly anecdotal evidence that, you know, millennials bring a different sort of expectation of sort of values and ideas about work-life balance and, you know, sort of the value of their whole self, you know, the holistic self, rather than just, you know, whatever's happening at work to the workplace. And you could then, I mean, you would follow from that as millennials sort of move up into, you know, levels into management, if they are the ones kind of setting the tone in the workplace. You know, it's interesting. You do see some companies where, you know, change is happening. Maybe it's happening slowly, but it's happening. I mean, you see it in tech, right? You see what Google and Facebook offer in terms of, you know, paid maternity and paternity leave, child bonuses, you know, things, a lot of things that actually in other countries, you know, the government takes care of, but, you know, they're offering to people in the U.S. You know, I think it's for them, my guess is a recruitment strategy, right? That you can come here and you can have a family and you're not going to be penalized for it. And that is like, it's a cognitive shift in how you're thinking about the lives of your workers. Either it, you know, takes a strong personality at the top to say, this is the culture that we're going to set. And I think, you know, it's hard to change those cultures. I mean, you see this in the UK, there, you know, there's now this 52 weeks of shared parental leave the new parents can take, and mothers and fathers can decide how to split it. But one of the problems that they found happen is that men aren't taking it, even though they're entitled to, because there's still a perception, even though you're allowed to take that time, like, are you discouraged? Right?
Well, there is a paternity leave penalty that still exists too. And it goes alongside a fatherhood bonus. What's interesting about this is that it only applies to like the really high end professions, mm-hmm. right? The ones that pay a lot mm-hmm. of money. And that is still a societal perception. In other words, that fatherhood is a valued quality in a male employee. Right? And it's like, unfair, but it's there.
But motherhood and mother is a liability.
I always go back to a couple of facts. One is that women are still graduating from college at a much higher pace than men are. And also that a lot of the jobs that are expected to be created in the future are jobs that traditionally have been dominated by women, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And so at some point, I think these things don't, you know, have any choice but to kind of, you know, revert back to something resembling equality. I hope, though. Right. I can't say that for sure.
Well, and I mean, you talked about this, I should say, on this podcast with Anne-Marie Slaughter, right? This question of, like, at what point do we really change, like, our perception and value of caregiving in general, right? Where it's not limited, frankly, to just to parenthood, but, you know, that where we sort of see these kind of roles that people have to take, whether it's for their elderly parents, like, you know, all these things, we're just going to have to consider things differently as a society. And it does feel like that change is coming, but maybe a little too slowly for our taste.
Well, you got to wet your beak a little bit. You got to dip your beak back in the podcast waters. What am I doing with this metaphor? Where's it going?
I don't know.
Isn't that, yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed having
you. Great to be back, and maybe I'll come down and pay you guys a visit before I'm back full time in the new year.
Excellent. But you know what we do at the end of each segment, right?
Recommendations.
Yeah. What's yours?
All right. So I'm going to recommend in this dire, dire political season, which thank God is almost over, I'm going to recommend two movies that we have recently rewatched. The first is Election with Reese Witherspoon, which is just in light of like this current race, you know, in brief, it is the tale of like an overachieving high schooler running for student council who is met with an unexpected challenge by like a popular dumb jock with a lot of money.
Would you say that was peak Witherspoon?
Oh, it's definitely. Well, no, actually, I would say that Cruel Intentions is peak Witherspoon. We also recently rewatched that, but it's just great. It's a great movie anyway, but it also feels very relevant. And then the other movie we watched recently that I had never seen before, which was amazing, is Brewster's Millions. It's like from the 80s. It's with Richard Pryor. He's a baseball player. He has to burn through a bunch of money, and so he runs a political campaign, and his party is none of the above. And I just feel like
you have to burn through a bunch of
money?
That's
the whole plot. I'm not going to give it away.
You don't give it away,
right? No. It's ridiculous. But again, as an indictment of the absurdity of our elections.
Shannon, see you next time.
Thanks so much, Cardiff.
And we are back here in the New York studio where I am joined by Catherine Rampell, a columnist at the Washington Post, also a former theater critic.
Also true.
Economics blogger, also at the New York Times in a former iteration of your career. Catherine, I actually still attribute all of your success to your having been an economics blogger in the first place. I think that laid the foundations for everything.
I mean, I still write a lot about economics, so it's not so far off from what I'm doing now.
But I feel like the depth of your columns, like the emphasis on data, forming your opinions with at least some grounding, not just in anecdotes, but in surveys and studies and research, all that has to be like from the good habits you picked up earlier.
Sure. I would like to think that most people would ground their own opinions in data. That's not always the case. But I do strive to find numbers that either support or disprove hypotheses that I have and go from there. And it turns out sometimes my hypotheses are wrong and I'll write about that, or sometimes I'll move on to other things. But yes, generally what I write about, I try to find, I get ideas from looking at surveys and government data releases, and I also dig into those kinds of things when I'm pursuing various ideas I already have.
Yeah, well, you do it beautifully. I'm going to start this segment by embarrassing you and making you all red-faced. I've said on Twitter before, I think you're the best columnist, new columnist added to the roster of a major American newspaper in like the last half decade or so. I totally meant it. Psyched to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Tell my boss.
What's that?
Tell my boss.
They should listen to our podcast and then have a bunch of other people subscribe too. Here's one topic that you've written a lot about, and it's going to be the focus of our conversation today. It's marriage trends, specifically for American young people, American millennials, or roughly the people in the ages of 18 to 34. I'm assuming that some of these trends probably also apply in other parts of the developed world. I don't see why these socioeconomic trends wouldn't. But let's talk about your column. So I want to start with one quote from a column you wrote at the end of last year. Here it is. Americans aged 18 to 34 are less than half as likely to be married as our counterparts were 50 years ago. Why don't we start by talking about what might be causing this and why it's important?
I think the popular perception is that millennials are just, in extended childhood. Even they're young adults, but they're in a sort of a period of extended adolescence. They don't want to settle down. They don't want to commit to people. They just want to party and go to brunch and whatever other terrible things millennials do. If you look actually at the data, at survey data about aspirations to get married, the vast majority of young unmarried people very much want to get married. They have idealized marriage to some extent. And one could argue that the reason why they are delaying getting married is not so much that they just all want to be, you know, bachelors and bachelorettes for the rest of their lives, but they don't feel like they have met the prerequisites that are necessary to take that step, both they and their potential mates. So if you look at perceptions of what you should have already crossed off your list, what sort of milestones you should have crossed off your list before tying the knot, there's a huge divide between what young people believe is a necessary step and what their elders believe. So things like, should you have already graduated college? Should you have paid down your debt? Should you own a home? Actually, like 4 in 10 young people believe that they should own a home before getting married. I guess that would mean that you might have 2 houses. I don't exactly, you know, depending on whether you're already cohabiting. You know, should you have lived together before getting married? Young people are much more likely to say yes than older people.
And the thing that makes a lot of those things possible, which is having a good job.
Yes. So where I was leading to, I should say, is that there are these new cultural changes in what people believe is necessary before getting married, both for themselves and for a potential mate. And layered on top of that is the fact that a lot of those milestones have drifted further out of reach. So having a stable job, paying down your debt, having already graduated college, you know, there are a lot of people who have enrolled in college but haven't finished, owning a home, those kinds of things have become prerequisites, but they are also harder to obtain. So you kind of have this layering effect of both changing cultural views and changing economic status that together is conspiring to make it harder for young people to feel like they're ready to get married.
Those things are harder to obtain. They also take a while. You know, if you look at the debt levels that college students come out of school with now, I mean, they're huge. And obviously, the average doesn't tell you exactly what everybody has. I mean, there's a lot of disparity there. But some people are coming out of school with tens of thousands of dollars in debt. That takes a while to pay down. And if you're going to pay it down, you also need a pretty good job. Young people, I think, were disproportionately hurt in the aftermath of the Great Recession as well. It seems like a lot of pressure for young people. Am I right?
Yes. And even the kinds of milestones that might seem easier to achieve, things like living together, are actually also very challenging. If you look at the share of people who are living with young people who are living with their parents, you know, they're living in their parents' basements or in the attic or whatever, you know, they're stuck at home because they can't afford rent. So even this thing that seems like it should be easier to achieve, which is just trying out living together, whether, you know, I'm not talking about the morality of this. I'm just talking about what people actually say that they think they should do before getting married. Even that is very challenging.
Yeah, I also really hate it when young people are denigrated for living at home with their parents when actually it's the responsible thing to do in many cases. They get these labels like boomerang kids, or you hear the cliche that they're all in their parents' basements playing video games or something. It all sounds a little bit ridiculous when so much of it just seems driven by circumstances. I mean, what else do we expect them to do?
Especially when you consider that relative to the rest of the developed world, we actually have a relatively low share of people, young people who are living at home prior to marriage. So it's a norm that we've had in the United States for a long time. But just because it's been a norm here doesn't mean it's necessarily objectively a good thing for young people to be living alone, or to be living outside of their parents' house in any case, particularly given the fact that for decades we have encouraged overinvestment in buying of houses. Sure. Amongst parents, right? I mean, through the mortgage interest deduction, we have been encouraging boomers, I mean, amongst others, to buy more house than they need. So, you know, basically we've been paying them to do this. So if they have more house than they need, why not allocate that resource more efficiently by saying, yeah, how's your own kids, you know, for a little while they're struggling to get a job that actually allows them to live outside of the house. And bear in mind, of course, that a lot of the young people who are living at home are not really there by choice. I mean, I love my parents, don't get me wrong, but I'm glad that I'm not living with them right now. The young people who are bunking up with their parents are doing so basically out of necessity, not because it's super fun to have mom and dad waiting on you all the time or whatever the stereotype is.
Yeah, there's an interesting way that you describe the cultural shift, too, between how people used to look at marriage versus how they look at it now. Before, marriage was something that you did shortly after school. It was something that you did as a way of kind of launching all the other things that you were going to do in your life, your career, your family, having kids, figuring out where you were going to live, stuff like that. Now it's considered more like a final achievement of having worked out everything that it means to be a young adult.
Yeah, the formulation that I've heard that I like, that I've often used, is the capstone versus the cornerstone model. This is not original to me. A lot of sociologists and economists have used this term. But basically what it means is, you know, rather than having marriage be the foundation of your economic security, that you first get married and have kids and then kind of work out the other stuff about career and housing and things like that, the cornerstone model, it's the capstone model. It's that after you have achieved all of these other milestones, as we were talking about, that's when you decide, okay, now I feel financially stable enough to get married. It's like marriage is more of a luxury good in a way than it used to be seen. It wasn't something that you did at the start of your career. Now you want to be settled in your career. You want to be on the right trajectory to making more money, to paying down your debt, to being able to support the kids that you, you know, maybe want to have. Then, you know, having marriage come at the beginning and then figuring out all the other stuff. Yeah. And there's a lot of debate amongst, you know, sort of on the less on the economic side and more on the social side of things, you know, amongst people who are worried about what does this mean for the family, if people are putting off getting married, particularly if they're putting off getting married but they're not putting off having children. What does that mean for children themselves, given that we know that, or it appears anyway, that a stable commitment between parents is generally a good, you know, the best setting financially amongst otherwise for children. Not the only setting, of course, but, you know, there are a lot of other questions that come up when you look at these types of numbers about what does this do for the economy, but also what does it do for how we interact with each other, with institutions, and how we think about poverty.
No, and even to diverge from the economics a bit more, and to, I guess, drift into the field of, I don't know, romance or something like that. Like, there's also the sense in which maybe this leads to a stabler kind of marriage if you achieve all these other things first, and then you're definitely sure of the person you're going to marry. But there seems to be like a sense of loss of like a shared history if you end up marrying somebody in your mid to late 30s versus in your early 20s, where you share the struggle with somebody all those years, right? Whereas later on, I think the formulation, and as you said earlier, this is not like specific to me, is that now it's more of like a partnership than it is two people trying to figure out how to hack their way into the world.
And you can romanticize either one, right? I mean, there is evidence to suggest that when people get married later, those unions are more stable, maybe partly because it's partly selection here, but the kinds of people who are getting married later are more settled in their career. They might have fewer stresses from financial problems, et cetera, because the mere fact that they decided to get married at that point suggests that they're battling fewer of those problems.
And maybe they know each other better. Or maybe they know themselves better.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of different theories. Obviously, we can't run a controlled experiment where we say, okay, you guys get married at 22 and you guys get married at 32, and then we'll see who does better. Like, that's not how life works. Right. Unfortunately, we can't test these things. We can only kind of try to tease out the data and say, well, here are the patterns we see. Maybe it's causal. Maybe it's not causal. But I mean, one bright side of the fact that people are putting off marriage, at least if you care about the stability of the unions, is that we have seen divorce rates go down.
Right.
Again, some of that may have to do with the kinds of people who are getting married. We haven't even talked about this, but it's kind of implicit in what we've discussing, which is that rich people or more highly educated people, I should say, are much more likely to get married than less educated people, which is something that was not always true, or at least the gap has grown. So those unions are maybe more stable because they're getting married at older ages. Maybe they're more stable because it's the other attributes that go along with the kind of person who is more likely to get married at an older age. But either way, the net effect is that divorce rates have gone down. And actually, one interesting thing that I've come across and that I wrote about, I think, a few months ago, is that Americans in general, but young people in particular, have gotten much more liberal on a lot of social issues. So things like is it okay for a woman to raise a child on her own? I don't remember exactly how it's phrased, out of wedlock, something like that. Right. Some of the language is loaded, obviously, but something like that. You know, is it okay for a woman to raise a child on her own? And the share of people who say yes has gone up. That's much less stigmatized. But if you ask about whether divorce is the right way for a couple that can't seem to get along to settle their differences, actually the share of people who are accepting of that has gone down. So people have become more approving of having children outside of marriage, of, you know, living in sin, so to speak, a lot of right. those other kinds of things, and they're more disapproving about divorce. And one possible interpretation of that has to do with this fact that people have idealized what marriage is, and that you should have, you know, you should have your stuff together by the time you get married, and therefore it's unacceptable to for your marriage to dissolve, because by the time you've gotten to that point, you should have everything figured out. You know, I think that's sort of the psychology here. Again, right. it has to do with this idealization of marriage, which is maybe good and maybe bad, but either way, people are becoming more judgmental of the divorces when they do occur,
right. yeah,
even though
have,
there are fewer
yeah,
of them.
This is fascinating. You have these two concurrent trends that don't seem to make sense, that are hard to reconcile, at least at first sight. You have, like, the sexual revolution, essentially. As you said, Americans getting more tolerant of people living in sin, but also of people starting to have sex younger, of children being had outside of marriage, of people just cohabitating indefinitely without getting married, even with kids, right? In other words, the family unit being defined as something different from something that necessarily has to be within a marriage. And then on the other hand, you have divorce rates falling. I guess when you look at the explanations that you just gave, it's no surprise then that marriage rates, especially for young people, have fallen. You mentioned the idealization of marriage, but at the same time, you have like the ability to get married by crossing off all of those things first, like sort of really hard for people to actually achieve all those things. And what ends up happening, and this is also a point in your column, is that people view either themselves or potential partners as unmarriageable because they haven't crossed off all
right,
those other
exactly.
ticks.
It's not only that these kinds of prerequisites, these milestones, apply to oneself. It's also that they apply to a potential partner. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but this is especially true for women, as I recall. So young women, when asked, you know, what's important in a mate, they're very likely to say, or more likely than men to say, that they should have a stable career, or stable income, something like that, you know, that that's important to them. And given that you have seen declining labor force participation rates amongst men, including prime age men, that suggests that there's a smaller share of men out there whom women view as marriageable, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of debate about exactly what it means to be marriageable within the academic community, but it's hard to argue with the fact that a lot of people see these kinds of qualities as key attributes, both for themselves. You know, they're holding themselves to these standards, but they're also holding their potential partners to these standards. And if you have these standards as being higher for one sex than the other, and that sex happens to be the one that is less likely to go to college, for example, and has seen earning potential fall, then that's not going to improve trends either.
Yeah. This is something I think about a lot, too, in the context of graduation rates, where we see that women are graduating college at a ratio of something like 6-4, right, or 3-2, I guess, female to male in terms of graduates now. And it seems like something where, you know, to the extent that this continues, and maybe it'll change, you know, over generations, but to the extent that all of the trends that you just mentioned continued, you're going to continue to see only very well-educated people getting married. And if anything, you might even see marriage rates amongst people without college degrees continue to fall.
We've also seen more what's called assortative matching, assortative mating, meaning that rather than the sort of Cinderella story where the rich or the highly paid, well-educated guy marries the less well-paid, less educated woman, or what, you know, these sort of
This is like these 1950s
yes.
Fairy tale ideal of,
you know,
what a marriage
Don
could
Draper
be.
Marrying right. his secretary, or whatever model you want to use. Those kinds of matches are much rarer than they used to be. Instead, what you're seeing is like marrying like, which means that college graduates are marrying college graduates. people who didn't go to college, to the extent that they are getting married, are marrying people who are equally as educated or as uneducated as they are. And one consequence of this is that, well, there are a number of consequences, but one big one is that actually it increases inequality, right? Because what happens is if like is marrying like and the richer pairs are marrying off and the less rich pairs are not, you have two people who are relatively well paid, relatively well educated, have a lot in assets, combining their fortunes, such as they are, and becoming even better off. And then the less educated, less well paid, poorer people not getting married and sort of staying poor and alone and not combining their assets. So you have this sort of exacerbation of trends that we've already seen in the economy, you know, in terms of growing inequality and segmentation of classes, but it's being reinforced by people only wanting to marry people who look like them, who are as equally as well educated and high earning as they are.
I think you also see in the research that this kind of assortative mating tends to rise and fall in line with the rise and fall of inequality itself. And you could kind of see how that would work. If you notice that inequality is climbing, you might lament it, right? You might notice it. You might even advocate for doing something about it, and I hope people do. But at the same time, you might want to get ahead of that trend, and you might be more likely to marry somebody who's like you if you are well-educated and you have high earnings potential, especially when you take into account the consideration of children, right? I mean, this is how it really threatens to kind of be a self-perpetuating problem. It's not just like marrying like and combining their fortunes and even being better off. It's that then they have those fortunes to bestow on their kids.
Right. And to drive home a point that you, it seems like you were getting at, you know, not to be so sort of crass and money grabbing about it, but one huge advantage of going to college is not only that it increases your own earnings, but it also increases the likelihood that you will marry someone who is of high earning potential as well. And, you know, people joke about going to college or going to grad school to get your MRS, if you're a woman. But this is true for men too, right? Yeah. That if they go to college, they're much more likely, A, to get married, and B, to get married to a woman who has better earning power. And this affects not only the family unit when it's just two parents, but it affects the amount of resources that they have to devote to children, the amount of time that they have to devote to children, and lots of other things that sort of spin forward these consequences.
Okay. Well, it's a fascinating chat. But Catherine, before we let you go, it is time for our long form recommendations. What do you think our listeners should be reading, watching, or listening to?
One book that I read recently that I quite enjoyed is called To Make Men Free. It's a history of the Republican Party. It's by Heather Cox Richardson. It came out a few years ago, but it's a really fascinating read about the genesis of the Republican Party, going all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, and how much the party's values have changed and the coalitions supporting Democrats and Republicans have evolved over time. Really fascinating stuff.
Okay. And my recommendation is Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. This is by Jessica Abel. It's written in cartoon form. I don't know if we refer to that as like a graphic work of nonfiction. I'm not totally sure, but essentially it goes behind the scenes of shows like Planet Money and This American Life. It has interviews with not just Ira Glass, but a lot of other people who have been sort of instrumental in constructing the new public radio and now podcasting environment that we're all in and in which Alpha Chat is obviously now participating in. Catherine Rimpel, this was such a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. You can reach us at 917-551-5012. For our overseas listeners, that's country code plus one. Email us at alphachat@ft.com. Also, please rate the show on iTunes. I'm not joking when I say that it helps a lot of people find us. And show notes, as always, are going to be at ft.com/alphachat. Special thanks for this episode to Merritt Bond Walker for providing some of the background noise, even if it did mostly consist of cooing and eyeing. And of course, the only third-party candidacy I would support is one with
Amy Keene, producer and editor of Alpha Chat, at the top of the ticket. I'm not qualified to be her vice president, but if you think you are, you can feel free to leave your qualifications when you email us. We, of course, hope that you do. Thanks, as always, to our listeners. We'll see you here again next Friday for another episode of Alpha Chat.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.